This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
6 months, six rate cuts. That's where the Federal Reserve left us today. Oh, and they said it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. And the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today, March 18th. Great to have you here. It has been a whiz-bang couple of days for the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. First, it bails out a big Wall Street investment bank. We told you about Bear Stearns yesterday, of course. It's also decided to start making loans to brokerage houses and securities dealers in yet another attempt to free up the credit markets. Used to be only big commercial banks could borrow from what's called the Fed's discount window. And then today, Mr. Bernanke and company jumped into the economic breach one more time. They cut short-term interest rates, just like everybody knew they would. The only real question was how much? Greg McBride's with Bankrate.com.
If the Fed had opted for a less aggressive move, cutting rates by, say, half a percentage point instead of three-quarters of a percentage point, you certainly wouldn't have been greeted with the euphoria on Wall Street. The market would have taken that as a big disappointment.
Two things to mention. First, the cut was actually right at 75 basis points. That's Wall Street talk for 0.75%. Also, the Dow was up almost 300 points when the Fed made its announcement. There was a hiccup or two, but all three major indices ended the day gaining more than 3.5% or more. That's in spite of some not-so-promising things the Fed said about what's coming down the pike, specifically that inflation is still a problem, but so is slowing economic growth. Again, here's Greg McBride.
The Fed is a delicate balancing act here between confronting the credit crunch now versus the prospect for inflation down the road.
The Federal Reserve, and more particularly its chairman, have taken no small amount of criticism since the economy started slowing last year. In at least one regard, though, you got to hand it to them. Yeah, Wall Street has lost some ground, but 1929 it ain't. There are, though, real worries more bank failures could be just around the corner. So, what is a central banker to do? Ashley Milne-Tite went looking for some answers.
That depends who you ask. Brian Gendreau is investment strategist for ING Investment Management. He says the Fed's doing what it can to get cash into the market, including lowering interest rates.
And I expect the Fed to do more of the same. I expect them to continue to ease. I don't think they're done. And I expect them to be innovative in how they provide liquidity to the financial system.
That could mean more auctions and more flexible borrowing terms for banks. Cheaper money could help allay investors' fears and entice companies and consumers to start spending again. Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, says the private sector is doing its bit too.
There have been efforts to add capital. There have been efforts to scale back risk. And all of that will continue. So the Fed doesn't have to fix the problem. All they have to do is keep the markets functional until the markets fix themselves.
When that happens, he says, it might be time to regulate some of the darker corners of the credit markets. Christopher Whalen of Institutional Risk Analytics says it's lack of regulation that got us into this mess in the first place.
The Fed and the Comptroller's Office were asleep at the switch. They let the street create this leverage nightmare.
There's plenty of support in the market for the Fed to cut rates further, but Whalen thinks that would be a mistake.
They're actually baking into the system the next crisis. Because if we have to drop rates down to where they were earlier in this decade, you're going to create another short-term bubble. And that doesn't help anyone.
He says the Fed should continue to provide liquidity to the market in times of need and leave it at that. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
All right, let's forget for a second about central bankers and start looking out for number one, because it's our money that Wall Street's playing with. That's our in the broadest sense. Mom-and-pop investors, mutual funds and retirement accounts, pension funds, day traders, everybody. So, how to make sense of the chaos? Daniel Scotto is the CEO of Whitehall Investment Advisors. Mr. Scotto, good to have you with us.
Good being with you.
Well, what is the individual investor supposed to make of what's going on Wall Street if the masters of the universe who are running that place can't quite figure it out themselves?
Well, it's very difficult. What we've seen by the Fed intervening in the Bear Stearns situation is trying to attempt to restore the markets to a normal functioning mode. So in effect, what the Fed did was by extending credit to a non-bank corporation was to prevent a run on all brokerage firms, not just Bear Stearns.
But when I hear you say things like restoring normal market operations, that kind of implies that things haven't been normal. And if I'm an investor, why am I hanging around, man? It's time to go.
Our view is that you should definitely take profits on these rallies. And as I said, we have to differentiate between the functioning of the market and the valuation of securities. And we haven't even settled the functioning of the market before we can even discuss the valuation of securities, which are grossly overvalued.
Let me ask you a general zeitgeist question, though. Is this, would you say, a buyer's market, specifically in stocks now, or is it a seller's market?
We think it's still a seller's market. Risk is really being repriced in here.
Explain what that means for me, risk is being repriced. We've been hearing that for months now.
Essentially, it's the price or the premium over treasury yields that investors are demanding to place their money in stocks. Not to be too technical, but in the reciprocal of the price earnings multiple.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't want to be too technical, because that helps.
Essentially, the sensitivity of the price earnings multiple. And what that's showing is that the price earnings multiple needs more E than P right now.
Let me pick up on something you mentioned a moment ago. Do you still believe that the stock market is overvalued?
Yes, the stock market is definitely overvalued. We have a high level of risk and not a commensurate level of reward.
So what is the individual investor to do here?
We think people should start to sit on the sidelines and let this play out and, again, wait for the market to return to a normalized behavior. We need to get the normalized functioning out of the way before we can begin to talk about valuations. And valuations are going to be a big function of what people feel their net worth is based on the value of their single largest asset, their homes.
You're telling me then that this whole thing is going to come down to how much the housing market either recovers or doesn't?
Yes, the largest asset in one's portfolio. Would you be buying additional stocks and bonds if you had another asset in your portfolio that kept declining in value? People are not inclined to buy, whether consume or buy stocks, when they feel that they are getting poorer.
Daniel Scotto is the founder and CEO of Whitehall Investment Advisors. Mr. Scotto, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Make of this what you will. Bear Stearns shares picked up almost 22% today, closed at almost $6. Remember J.P. Morgan's offer over the weekend? $2 a share. And you knew this part was coming. The Securities and Exchange Commission said today it's looking into some things that Bear executives said in the days leading up to this weekend's bailouts. As I mentioned, quite a day on Wall Street, but look at gold if you want a recession indicator. The price of what is usually considered the safest of safe havens in an economic storm fell $23 an ounce today. We'll have the details, and I would wager the really happy music when we do the numbers. was guns in the Supreme Court today. The biggest Second Amendment case in 70 years was on the docket. Tomorrow, it's going to be money. The justices will hear a challenge to a California law that prevents employers from spending public money on anti-union activities. Nine other states, including New York and Ohio, have similar statutes. From Washington Marketplace's John Dimsdale has our preview.
The Bush administration has joined national business groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in challenging California's restrictions on using state money to fight union organizing. Attorney Mike Carvin, representing the chamber, says the state ban directly contradicts national policy.
Federal law makes it clear that they not only allow employers to engage in that kind of speech, they want them to engage in that kind of speech because it's of great benefit to the employees on making an informed decision about whether or not to join a union.
The ban affects only companies that do business with states and collect taxpayer money. That's mainly healthcare providers, hospitals, and nursing homes that rely heavily on income from state Medicaid payments. Jeffrey Sharon represents healthcare companies that are challenging New York's law.
The freedom to organize is written into federal and state law, but so is the freedom to oppose it. If what you're doing is tying the hands of just one side, it puts the unions at a very substantial advantage.
But the attorney for the AFL-CIO, Scott Cronlund, says this isn't about free speech.
Employers are perfectly free to try to influence their employees about whether to unionize. They just can't use the state's money to do that. They have to use their own money.
A U.S. appeals court upheld the state law last year, but the Supreme Court voted to hear the business challenge. A ruling is expected in late June. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Oil's at 109-something a barrel. The planet's getting warmer, so the search is on, actually has been on for a while now, for new sources of clean energy. Nuclear power is making a comeback. More than 100 new reactors are being built or are planned in Europe, Asia, and across the developing world. In Germany, though, nuclear's on its way out. Berlin's vowed to shut down its last reactor by 2022. Thing is, it's also promised to cut its carbon dioxide output by 40% by 2020. Brett Neely reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk that doing both is going to be a neat trick.
The western German town of Grevenbroich calls itself Germany's capital of energy. Three massive brown coal power plants here produce enough cheap energy to power Germany's biggest industrial region, the nearby Ruhr Valley. The plants also release epic amounts of carbon dioxide, over 60 million tons a year. That's earned the town another name, the CO2 capital of Europe. Another huge power plant is due to come online next year. Hans Wilhelm Schiffer is the director of energy economics for RWE, the utility that owns the plants.
Coal has become more important because of the phase-out of nuclear energy.
Brown coal, also known as lignite, is so dirty that it makes the black stuff look good. But it's also dirt cheap. This part of Germany sits atop some of the biggest brown coal reserves in the world. By some estimates, there's another 200 years' worth of coal here. Although the future of coal looks bright in Germany, the view from Monica Hermkes' window is decidedly darker. The giant clouds of steam coming from the plants can block out the sun in front of her house for days.
I see a windmill from my window, and it doesn't disturb me nearly as much as the power plant does. It goes whoosh, whoosh, but the power plant rumbles loudly.
Hans Wilhelm Schiffer says his utility is spending €1 billion a year to increase the use of solar and wind power. But he says that won't provide enough energy to replace coal or nuclear plants. And natural gas? Too expensive. So according to Schiffer, all roads lead back to brown coal.
And lignite is the only domestic energy source that offers sufficient reserves on a large scale.
And if so, that almost 30 new coal power plants are in the planning for the next decade, which would make it impossible for Germany to keep its promise to cut CO2 emissions by 40%. Across the country, German citizens are suing the utilities and have managed to stop the construction of some new coal plants. Energy economist Claudia Kempfert says the government needs to decide what's more important, cutting coal and CO2 or eliminating nuclear plants. If it can't make up its mind, she says, the country is headed for an electricity crisis.
I would think that within the next 5 years we might face real problems and danger of blackouts.
In which case, she says, Germany would have to import power from other countries who use coal or nuclear. Hans-Wilhelm Schiffer at RWE says the decision may not be as difficult as it seems.
And I would say coal is not the problem, but part of the solution of the CO2 reduction question.
He says this new brown coal plant will be the most efficient in the world. It will emit one-third less CO2 than an older plant. It's also designed to work with new carbon capture technology that pipes the gas underground. But that technology won't be ready until at least 2020. Economist Claudia Kempfert is skeptical about that timeline. And she says even if carbon capture works, get ready to say auf Wiedersehen to cheap electricity.
There are studies showing that the electricity price would double with this technology.
Electricity prices have already doubled here since 2000. If prices go much higher, Germans may well decide they prefer to sit in the dark. In Gravenbroich, Germany, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace. Coming up, when a penny saved might be two pennies earned.
Like anything, there's a possible chance of a good return, but there are a lot of factors that are going against you.
But first, let's do the numbers. Bernanke speaks, Wall Street listens, and thus we get the really happy music. The Dow Industrial shot up 420 points today, 3.5% to close at 12,392. The Nasdaq shot up 91 points, 4 1/10%, 22.68 at the bell. The S&P 500 put on 51 points, 4 1/4%, 13.30 is the number there. Financial stocks led the rally. Lehman zoomed up 46%. Goldman Sachs climbed 16%. J.P. Morgan pushed up 6%. Easy Money also revived some bruised housing and banking stocks. The moribund Countrywide zoomed up nearly 25% today, while Pulte Home stepped up 11%. Oil prices helped Exxon climb 3%. Chevron up 2.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.48%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, President Bush speaks about the war on terrorism. Several protests are planned in the Capitol, marking the five-year anniversary of the Iraq War. And the act of springing forward and falling back was introduced 90 years ago. The U.S. Standard Time Act was passed on March 19, 1918, establishing time zones and daylight savings time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
It's nice to be home after a couple of weeks on the road. We are back from our special series, The Middle East at Work. Marketplace did a week in Cairo and a week in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Not everybody loved it. Some of you thought we shouldn't be worrying about the rest of the world when the U.S. economy is in trouble. Others wrote to say they were put off by one peculiar fact of life in Dubai. Magdi Saba of Baltimore, Maryland, was there last summer.
What's interesting is that you can almost completely avoid contact with Emiratis other than the passport official at the airport. This has to change in order for Dubai to become the city it strives to be.
Actually, that is probably not going to change anytime soon. Hundreds of thousands of South Asians, Pakistanis, Indians, and Bangladeshis mostly, are being imported to help build Dubai. Plenty of others want to go, too. We got a surprising number of emails during the series from people asking us if we could help them find jobs over there. New York City native Khalid Ali is of Pakistani descent. He's already got a job in Dubai. He starts this week. But his background will put him in a curious position.
I think I will be treading an ambiguous line as both a member of the Western expat clique and, at least ethnically, a kinsman of the lower laborer class.
Since it was a special series, we changed a couple of things, music especially, from the theme all the way through the program to the last thing you hear.
وسائل الإعلام الأمريكية.
Lots of you wrote to ask what exactly she was saying. David Burns from Boston, Massachusetts, did his best David Letterman impression.
Number four, she's politely telling me to go away. Number three, she's blessing me and asking me to come again. Number two, she's trying to sell me a barrel of oil. And my number one guess, American Public Media, right?
Right, Char. Mr. Burns may be the best letter we ever got. There have been other things on the program the past couple of weeks. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler, a resident of Los Angeles, started his story about hospitals dumping homeless patients with this setup line.
When you or I leave the hospital, we generally go home.
That didn't sit too well with Noah Miller. He lives up in the San Francisco Bay Area, Oakland, California.
You better think again about just who you're talking to, Jeff. I don't know about L.A., but here in San Francisco, I've passed by presumably homeless people listening to public radio. Perhaps we're just more refined up here.
Perhaps. And finally, a correction. We reported yesterday on the looming clash of office cultures should the Microsoft bid for Yahoo go through. We ended with the observation that the Microsoft cafeteria only offers free orange juice, not coffee like they get at Yahoo. That didn't sit too well with some Microsoft employees who wrote to say they do indeed get free Java, supplied by that other famous Seattle company, the one that makes all the coffee. Send us your thoughts, no matter your beverage of choice. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The heck with what all the experts say. The people have spoken on the subject of whether or not we are in a recession. Three-quarters of Americans say, you bet we are. That's according to a USA Today Gallup poll that came out this morning. But commentator and economist Tyler Cowen says we ought to define our terms.
You've probably heard and read that the American economy is in a recession. But what exactly does that mean? In reality, the label is more of a fiction than anything else. Calling it a recession is something we do to make ourselves feel better. Naming offers a sense of control, or at least it alleviates our feelings of helplessness. Talk of a recession is also like talk of the weather. It creates social bonding, or it allows you to take the emotional thermometer of other people. The formal label, recession, usually comes much later than does the recession itself. For an economist, a recession is defined by the formidable-sounding Business Cycle Dating Committee, based at the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This committee looks at a lot of numbers, thinks really hard, and one day announces that a recession has come. The thing is, the committee usually doesn't render a judgment until 6 to 9 months after the recession has started, mostly because they want to be sure. So even if a recession started in December, as most economists think, it won't be announced until May or later. These definitions are useful to academics, but no use at all to people looking for jobs or trying to start new businesses. Today, you can bet on the question of whether a recession will come. Take a look at the online market at intrade.com. The obsessive can get a new and slightly different number each time they hit reload. Lately, the betting odds of recession are running over 70%, and that reflects the knowledge held by the most informed market traders. If you know better, you can bet enough money and shift the odds yourself. So, the discourse on recessions has been democratized. And today, the best source on whether a recession is coming is, quite simply, you.
Tyler Cowen is a professor of economics at George Mason University. His blog is called Marginal Revolution. If you're among the 76% of Americans that believes we are in a recession, let us know. Our website is marketplace.org. One penny is not going to buy you very much these days. There aren't even many truly penny stocks left out there. eBay's got a few things listed for $0.01, but your computer probably doesn't need a floppy disk drive anymore now, does it? So no wonder we toss them into jars on our dressers. But with the price of copper near record highs, some people are banking on pennies paying off big. Mary Rose Abraham reports.
Here's what you'll find in Todd Kramer's garage at his home in Michigan. A silver minivan,
a large collection of tools and equipment, a few boxes of odds and ends, and 4 tons of pennies.
So now I'm probably about 1.1 million pennies, and I'm adding something on the order of maybe about 100,000 copper pennies per month.
That's about 11 grand in pennies, and Kramer, who's only been collecting them for a year, isn't even especially fond of the coins. He sees them as an investment.
I'm quite happy to pay 1 penny for something that's worth 1 or 2.2 pennies.
Or something that might be. Pennies before 1982 are 95% copper. And based on the current price, the copper in a pre-82 penny is worth about 2 cents. So Kramer figures his penny stash is really worth about 24,000. And he's not stopping at that. He visits about 8 local banks a week, where the tellers know him simply as the penny guy.
Most of the banks I interact with, they think I'm outright crazy, but you walk in with a few pieces of paper that fit in your wallet very lightweight, and then struggle out the door with 120 pounds of metal.
About 1/3 of the pennies will be worth their weight. The rest, Kramer rolls up and returns to a whole other set of banks, what he calls dump banks. He used to sort the coins by hand. Now he has 3 machines that separate the pennies by weight. It's hard to know how many penny hoarders are out there. RealSent, an internet forum, has about 500 members, with names like Penny Prospector and Metallophile. Andy Redlin goes by Rydale. He invented the coin sorter, also called Rydale, and says he sold about 100 of them in the U.S. and Canada.
I have engineers, accountants, doctors, lawyers, people that are just generally aware of the intrinsic value of metals in general.
Copper prices have nearly tripled over the last 3 years. That's according to Jonathan Day, a senior broker at Cannon Trading in Beverly Hills. The firm deals in copper and other commodities. Day thinks hoarding pennies is an iffy investment strategy.
Like anything, there's a possible chance of a good return, but there are a lot of factors that are going against you with your penny investment.
Starting with the fact that it's illegal to melt down or export pennies and nickels. Violators face a fine of $10,000 or 5 years in prison. So hoarders say they're waiting to see if the year-old ban will be lifted. But what they'd really like is for the penny to be retired. Then they can legally turn their coins into scrap metal.
You're basically banking on the hopes that your penny will be discontinued.
And while they're waiting for that, hoarders might also take a closer look at their millions of coins. There may be something really valuable buried in there, like a 1955 double-struck penny. One of those could be worth thousands of dollars. Then hoarders would really be getting their 2 cents worth. In Los Angeles, I'm Mary Rose Abraham for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions, Constellation.com. And by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, if you're hoping for some consolidation in the airline business to improve service and help get you where you're going on time, well, you're going to be disappointed to hear the news out of Delta Airlines today. The country's number 3 carrier said it's going to offer buyouts to about 30,000 workers. Management's hoping about 2,000 actually take them up on the offer. It'd be a cut of about 3% of the workforce. Perhaps more relevant, Delta also said it hasn't been able to work out a deal with its pilots union over a possible merger. Northwest has been mentioned as the most likely partner there. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow jumped 420 points, 3.5%. The Federal Reserve gets most of the credit there. The NASDAQ rose 91 points, 4.1%. The S&P 500 packed on 51 points, 4.25%. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on the program, taking a gamble on state lotteries.
Why not? My chances are as good as anybody else's. I'd like to pay off a few bills if I could. But I have a grandson I'd like to see go to college. Powerball, we do it.
Yeah, sure it would. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.